Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Okay, today we're talking about cancel culture with the brilliant essayist Kaylin Ford, documentarian who wrote a great essay in the American Mind called They Can't Cancel Your Soul. And we're dealing with Lori Lightfoot. The wheels on the bus are popping off Lori Lightfoot's administration. There's a mutiny at City Hall. She doesn't want to talk to certain reporters. She's using skin color to decide who's going to tell her story, which wasn't the Lori Lightfoot I knew. Jeff Carlin is here as always, executive producer at WGN Radio. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, nationally syndicated columnist at the Chicago Tribune, member of its editorial board. Jeff has some insights on Lori Lightfoot's comm operation, and so do I. And Kaylin Ford, well, she's just an amazing writer, and I can't wait for you to hear her. On the Chicago Way, on WGN Plus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Right, so the other day, I was fascinated by a tweet by Marianne Ahern, NBC5 News, longtime political reporter. She tweeted that Lori Lightfoot has decided only to do interviews with journalists of color.
Their tweet was to mark the mayor's second anniversary in office. She is only just that. I just want to give her the pretense so no one calls us out or tries to say we're twisting the situation. But the
No. We're not. This is not about right. Twisting.
Right. I just want to clarify. That was her full tweet. Because she's a journalist, a real journalist. She wasn't putting out any opinion. She was just putting out the facts.
Well, opinion's not wrong.
She
was just playing it straight. Okay. And here's the deal. Jeff, we talk about this on the Chicago Way because this is Lori Lightfoot is on the Chicago Way. She's been a guest here. She's living it. The wheels on her bus are coming off as we speak. There's a lot of things going on at City Hall where aldermen are meeting, saying what's going on. I was talking to aldermen last night and this morning, what's going on? I expect, stories to come out. And also, Lori Lightfoot, if you're listening, Lori, you know, because you were a guest here and you did love to come here when you needed us, against Tony Preckwinkle, here's the deal. Walk it back publicly now, like yesterday. But she won't because she's stubborn.
And she already hasn't. I mean, in the time that we've been talking here, she posted on her Twitter that she is trying to right the wrong of not enough diverse representation and enough journalists asking her questions that represent other people, the minorities, other groups in the city. And she's sticking to this. This is her thing. Yeah. And you know what? And I'll play devil's advocate for the purposes of our conversation.
Oh, come on. I was the devil's advocate this morning before we did the show, but okay, you can be the devil's advocate.
I'll play it for just one hand.
Right.
There is, you said you hit it on the nose there that this is the Chicago way. This is how it was. You know, this is the things we've riled against forever that the dailies were doing before her. I mean, it was happening that people were, they were giving credence and giving favors to those that they represent them and that are like them and other constituents, but the people who are, you know, hey, how you doing types. And people, she's now saying, well, I'm turning that on my head and I'm going to do it myself. So I mean, that's essentially my take on what she's done.
Jeff Carlin, it is amazing that she's done this. Here's my take. Are there enough people of color in journalism? I say no.
No.
But I don't think about people as, I don't think skin pigment determines whether you should get a, I'm all about merit and I'm all about opportunity. I'm not about this judging and dividing on the basis of race. Mm-hmm. And as she became more and more confused in her first year, and I defended her, Jeff, how long have I been defending her up until recently? Right.
Yeah.
Getting a lot of crap from people, mm-hmm. the readers. I just think this is the wrong thing for her to do. I understand her right to choose whoever she wants to interview. And I really don't really care about those interviews. I'm not interested in stage.
Right. And the content is not going to be.
Right. It's all, they're all commercials. You can wear a fuzzy sweater like Rom did, you know, and be soft and nice. Or you can, weep and be like Daly, you know, I love the city or whatever he used to say. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean anything. What means something is assessing the individual. And here's my assessment, Jeff. She came in, she did the Chicago way repeatedly. She'd call because she was afraid of Tony Preckwinkle. And the truth is, she was almost going to pull the plug.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to you about this. Tony Preckwinkle got in the race. Rahm was out. She was saddened. She was like, I'm screwed here. You know, we were talking.
Right.
And I said, look, you're not screwed. You can fight this thing. Come on the Chicago way. She goes, would you have me? I said, yes, of course. How many times did we have her? 3-4 times?
Yeah, I think it was 3 times, yeah. And I remember even just seeing the look in her face in the talking about that, not having Rahm to run against. You know, it was a huge deal because that was, I mean, the majority of what she was running against was this idea that there was, you know, old white guys running the city for their benefit and the benefit of their friends.
That's legitimate. That was the wave that she rode on. But here's the problem. She came in. We told her. I told her. You told her.
Yep.
And others did say, you know, now that you're the outsider, the outside reformer or whatever the character that she was playing, she had to have people that understood the politics of Chicago. She needed people who could go down into the rat holes and find the rats and either kill them or negotiate.
Right. Convert them.
Convert them, negotiate. She needed people who could tell her no, just like Daly had. Mm-hmm. When Rahm had no one to tell him no, guess what happened?
Yeah.
He, you know, maybe somebody should have said, release the video, apologize for it, and, you know, whatever. But he didn't. He didn't do it.
No.
And now Lori's in the position where no one tells her no. And her allies in the city council are, I just spoke to them. They're freaked out.
Yeah.
Because you know why? Her base is not the West and South sides. Her base is the North side, white progressives. And it's not good for her. You know, I guess maybe white progressives will go along with if you play a race game and I'm only going to talk to black reporters and brown reporters, but I don't think it's good for the city and not for her.
Right.
And she's too smart for this. So I think her staff is like completely, they're gone. They're I don't know where they come from.
Yeah. I don't either. And I look at it, you know, John, it's kind of my sweet spot or one of my passions is looking at the idea of how people communications and the idea of marketing your message really comes down to. And I was telling you that we were talking about this before we got on here, but the thought is that, you know, absolutely, if this is what she wants to do, if she wants to make a statement,
Power to you,
to draw the attention, there's absolutely a way to do it. And this was not the way to do it. If she had that institutional muscle, if she had those connections, if she didn't spend the last 2 years browbeating any reporter who asks her a tough question, she would be able, her communications people would have been able to go into these various organizations and say, hey, listen, the mayor wants to mark her 2-year anniversary and she'd like to highlight minority reporters and journalists in your organization.
Just it would still be any editor worth his salt would say, no, we don't do that. But I'm sure that there are many broadcast venues that would accept it.
Yeah, and I'm sure there would. And at the very least, it would be above board in the sense that, okay, I get it. What we were trying to do, you're trying to draw this out there, fine. But we're not going to do it, and it's a bad idea. And
so then, clumsy.
And then, right, and then they would have gotten off the record, they would have gotten the pushback on it, realizing, hey, this is stupid. This is not going to go over well. Every one of these newsrooms is going to get pissed at us. Let's abandon this idea and come up with something else, which I don't know. How about the mayor takes up, you know, some of her own money and raises money from her friends and starts a bunch of scholarship programs for minority journalists.
Right.
That would have been the way you could have done this. I mean, I get it. It's a win on the face value that everyone's talking about the concept, but it's a loss because it makes her look just foolish. I mean, just, you know, Bush League.
It makes her look weak, which is what she is. And if you're listening, Lori, I don't think you have much time. Go and change yourself. Get a makeover from some consultant. Change your personality. Change your marketing, your approach. People, look, there are other issues besides Lori Lightfoot's cleaving to race identity. You know, there's like, and just like, you know, like the Lakeshore Drive. I mean, what is that?
Right.
That's just renaming. That's just stunt. But there's children are being shot every day in the city of Chicago.
Right.
We just had like May. How many just in this month? How many children have been shot down? And taxes.
There's lead in the water in this city. There's violence on the streets. There's uneducation happening in the schools, and our finances are circling the drain and for a grander scale. And this is the thing we're going to focus on, that there aren't enough minorities in newsrooms. And yeah, this is how you're going to do it? Come on.
I do think there should be more minorities in newsrooms.
Absolutely.
And
in our posting of this, you know, and kind of gearing up for this interview, you know, someone or our podcast today, someone did point out, oh, yeah, John Cass and Jeff, they never talked to any minority people. So how are they have a point to say? Okay, point taken. Then
I don't know. What about Jamal Green? Exactly. Wait, what about Jamal Green? What about Lori Lightfoot? What about Crawford and other people who were activists on the left?
Right.
Come on.
What? I know, I'm just saying that I'm like, fine, I'll take the intro. I'll look in on myself first before looking outward. That's all I'm trying to cover there. Mm-hmm. But the greater point is that, this is not this just makes it just so bad. It's just such a bad look. And it's going to get picked up by all the national media, which is, I'm sure, is in the back of her mind when she does stuff like this, if not the front of her mind. And it's just embarrassing.
So she'll be the, you know, I probably should write a column on it. She'll be the MSNBC heroine. Mm-hmm. Right, she'll be the progressive heroine, but
I'm sure Rachel Maddow is going to spend 5 minutes on this, giving her lots of accolades.
But I'm not a Rachel Maddow critic now, because she did, in a moment of searing honesty, talked about her mass dysphoria and confusion when the CDC came up with the mask idea.
I'm not knocking her by any means, but the fact is that this is right in her wheelhouse for what the type of people she likes to highlight.
Right, but you know, on the same time, If you walk down Michigan Avenue, you need cash to give to people so they won't stab you in the neck, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have friends that live on Michigan Avenue. They're terrified of what's going on. They just see what they don't like to see. And it's not black people. It's aggression, and it's a feeling of impending violence. And that, too, gets lost and mm-hmm. conflated in the tribal sense that, you know, tribal political sense that we'll talk about. We'll talk about this in a few minutes with Kaylin Ford, who was, I just think she's a brilliant woman. And we'll get into it with her and her piece, They Can't Cancel Your Soul. But Jeff, Carlin, I've got aldermen on my phone calling me saying, WTF, WTF. I've got reporters saying, I don't want to say anything out loud because they're, you know, now they're afraid.
Right.
There's nothing that frightens white liberal reporters more than the prospect of being called a racist by some cartoon head on Twitter, you know, who's in his mom's basement. Guess what? I'm not a liberal. I was born in the city of Chicago. I don't give two figs what you think. I don't really care about people's race.
Yeah.
I care about this. I want a strong mayor who's competent. And I thought Lori Lightfoot would be that mayor. And Jeff, can she be that mayor by doing this stuff?
Nah, I mean, she's trying to be too much to too many people. She came in as a reformer and she did some things. And now she's in as a social, now she's pivoted to being a social justice warrior of a mayor. I mean, we'll see what the next 2 years bring, but I guarantee it won't bring a reelection.
The stunning racism of all this, and I'm going to pick people of color, or how about if she said, I'm only going to talk to white people, white reporters, either way.
Yep. Well, I mean, she completely carved out anybody who's Asian, apparently. That group doesn't matter. I mean.
But here's the thing. Franz Spielman is, last time I checked, white. Marianne Ahern, white. Carol Marin, white.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what? I don't see them as, I don't, I mean, I'm sorry. I'm still one of those people who think, as Dr. Martin Luther King taught us, you know, just what's the content of their character? And these women, these accomplished women, you know what they would ask? They wouldn't ask dumb questions about how you feel. They would ask, why didn't you take care of the riots and the looting on the second and third time that you lost control? What about these emails that are out there? Mm-hmm. What about the budget? Why are kids still not in school?
Oh, what about the lead in the water, John? I mean,
Bayless was talking about this on our podcast
years ago. You're right. And it hasn't gotten better. They haven't done anything to fix it. They sent out water filters to people and tested water in all these areas.
Yeah.
Oh, we're talking about it.
Well, you're getting billions from the federal government,
right?
But you know why, you know, you're spending it on nonsense, or let's have an Obama library or whatever we're spending it on, and not on the lead in the water that's affecting the brains of children, mm-hmm. most of whom are black and brown.
Yep. Vastly
outnumbered. Vast majority.
And mm-hmm. and that's impact today you could change and make those lives better without having to only talk to reporters to represent those people. I mean, there's plenty of people.
Right, because it's just politics, man. It's just like identity mm-hmm. politics gone bad. She's not the mayor of just, you know, some races and not others. She's the mayor of the entire city. She should understand that. She should be offering calmness and concern and leadership.
And raising these issues about diversity in a productive manner. This is not productive.
What about before we get the troll? I have trolls, and you know what? I love blocking trolls now. You're a troll, I block you. I don't have to deal with that crap, okay? I just block you, and I love it. I feel like rolling over. I blocked about 100 of them the other day. You know, they're all connected to the CTU or one way or another. Right. Or they're all left wingers. And I have my left wing friends, but I'm not going to deal with trolls. So, what's the segue, though, Jeff? Save me. What's the segue about? Oh, so yes, so that we don't have trolls attacking us for not supporting Lori Lightfoot's critical race theory in journalism.
Right.
It suggests to me that the wheels on her bus are popping off, and that will she make it to another term? Jeff,
you're having me on record saying there's a snowball chance in hell that she's going to be reelected.
But is it she even going to run? That's a question. Yeah, it's almost like
that's a good question.
She's on the verge right now, everybody, as we speak right this second, of a real council mutiny, not just from progressives, but from all of them, and they're all meeting now, and I think. You know, Louis Gutierrez might be involved, and many other Latino aldermen are involved, and they're going to use the vehicle of hybrid school board, to leverage themselves into a larger discussion. But whatever it is, Lori, take care of your business and run the city, and quit playing to MSNBC. Because there are many people who want to believe in you, and you know what? They're leaving Chicago.
Yeah, absolutely.
She endorsed Kim Fox, for God's sake, after she said she wouldn't.
Yeah.
After she criticized her, then she endorsed her. Her staff, her political acumen is zero. She's had, I think, bad advice from the beginning. She's allowed herself to be isolated, and she's in a bubble. And who does she have in that bubble? A bunch of people from out of who don't understand politics. And you know what? Don't just trust me. Talk to progressive aldermen, and maybe not the psycho progressives, you know, but liberal aldermen who are concerned.
Absolutely,
and they see it too.
Yep, and she needs to stop doing these videos and these things that serve no purpose and are just ridiculous about announcing Lollapalooza or the mask thing.
Wait. Before we go, you have to explain now, we know that after the masks were released, we could get out of the masks. She went on MSNBC to say, no, I'm going to wear masks in public. Really?
Right.
That's just moronic. But what about Lollapalooza? You have to tell people...
This is just another episode in the long running. And if you can hear, I've got one of my cats behind me calling at me. But one of my biggest complaints about the mayor's office and the way she handles communication is the fact that it's needlessly tone deaf to the reality of a lot of situations. Two, the quality is terrible. I mean, they can't get her to read a sentence in one take, and they edit it out, and it just looks bad. But the latest incident was Lollapalooza is coming back. I'm sure everybody's seen that news. But last week, the week before, as we taped this, there was Variety, I believe it was, got the story that Lollapalooza was absolutely going to happen this year. And by all assumptions, I got it from someone within the Lollapalooza universe, who, you know, a Perry Farrell type. And confirmed it. Yep, I've talked to the mayor. We're going to do it. We're just working out the details, but here's what it's going to be. And yeah, it's going to be awesome. But you know, you can't quote me on that. So Variety runs with it because there's no greater source, right? And the mayor's office is asked about it, and the mayor's office responded with very curt emails saying that's erroneous. It's misguided. That's not true. You know, it's not.
She knocked it down.
Right. And the only reason they did that was so that they could put out a video yesterday of the mayor, a poorly edited again video that was just not needed. So she could do that. So she could be the star and this video could go viral on social media. And it's that idea that it's all about her image. It's all about how she can look good doing this or look good doing that. It's that is not what she was elected for. She was elected to root out the jackasses on city council who are take our money and use it for their friends, and to fix the finances of the city to make it more equitable. And I'm using that in the sense of those of us who are all citizens and aren't powerful and equitable. And that happened for a few months. And now where we are, I don't even know.
Well, there we are. Lori Lightfoot's driving the Jed Clampett truck on the Chicago way. The wheels are coming off. Granny's bouncing in the back. She's going to fly off any minute. Jethro's can't even push anymore. He's so tired. It's really getting bad, and it's only going to get worse.
Today, Chicago Mayor Lightfoot's two-year anniversary in office. To mark that occasion, Lightfoot announced she would only grant one-on-one interviews to black and brown journalists. WGN political reporter Tamon Bradley sat down with her to learn more about that decision.
Your office says that you invited black and brown journalists to this round of interview. Why? I'm happy to vouch for Craig Wall, for Heather Sharone, and others.
Well, look, I think in this one day, when we are looking at the two-year anniversary of my inauguration, as a woman of color, as a lesbian, it's important to me that diversity is put front and center.
Mayor Lori Lightfoot defending her most unusual decision to only invite black and brown journalists to her office for one-on-one interviews.
In speaking of cancel culture, the left mocks it and says it doesn't exist, although it does. And then some people misuse the term, like that idiot horse breeder. What's his name, Jeff? The one who said that Medina...
Bob Baffert, Medina Spirit.
Bob Baffert. He said he was, because his horse was doped, that it was all about cancel culture. Really, sir? I don't think so. But then you have other people, the list keeps growing of people who are exiled for their thoughts. And we have as our guest, Kaylin Ford, from Canada, documentarian and former candidate for the parliament. My full disclosure here, my Uncle Gus was a member of parliament. He was a veterinarian from Owen Sound and Canadian parliament. My mom was born in Canada. And I think somewhere in family legend, my uncle Jimmy Geddes, who was, I think, 90 when I first met him, had been a bootlegger with several of the prominent politicians in Canada at the time. So with that as an introduction, we want to welcome Kaylin Ford to the Chicago Way.
Thank you very much for having me this morning.
Kaylin, your piece, and I recommend it most highly, probably the best thing I've read all year, was a piece in the American Mind, They Can't Cancel Your Soul. And the subheadline, Fear Not Those Who Can Destroy the Body. I first read it and recommended it to my friend Dan Proft. When I sat in with him, you came on the show and talked briefly about it, but I wanted to do a deeper dive.
Of course.
So, first of all, tell us, since I do have trolls of the left who twist everything I say, tell us what happened to you.
I was a fairly prominent candidate for the provincial legislature in my home province of Alberta, Canada. And I'd been campaigning for about 9 months. I was running in a very competitive swing seat against the woman who was then the justice minister for the opposing party. And as the election approached, the polls seemed to be going my way. And it was less than 1 month before the election. A website affiliated with my political opponents published, I'll call it a blog post. It had no byline, no author. And it was an anonymous accusation saying that in the course of an academic conversation years earlier, they said that I had echoed white nationalist rhetoric. And they didn't disclose the full transcripts of that conversation. So no one was ever allowed to scrutinize that. But they took what seemed to be a couple sentences and edited them and redacted them deceptively and put them in a new context. And they said that I was expressing sympathy with white supremacist terrorists. This was 3 days after the Christchurch mosque massacre in which 50 people were killed at prayer. And so they're one of the statements that they made in this article was days after 50 innocent Muslims are slaughtered at prayer, does the Conservative Party really want a candidate who says white supremacist terrorists are misunderstood? She needs to be disqualified immediately. And I was effectively almost immediately, there was a sort of a social media pylon. My political opponents were amplifying this message. There was really no incredulity at all on the part of the mainstream media, who picked up this narrative almost verbatim and started repeating it. And so I had to resign my candidacy, and there was really no opportunity for a defense. Instead, actually, when I attempted to speak and to explain what I had actually said and meant and what the real context was, the radio host that I spoke with faced petition campaigns and boycott campaigns, and activists threatened to go after her advertisers and deplatform her for giving me an opportunity to respond to these accusations. So it was extremely swift. And it's just sort of it's sort of a horrifying position to be in, because I think any of us, if we're being honest with ourselves, could say that we have said things in the course of private conversations, which, if taken out of context and altered by people who intend to misinterpret us in bad faith, then no one is really safe from that. No one's impervious to this kind of thing.
We are speaking on the Chicago Way to Kaylin Ford, 32, wife, mother of two children, award-winning documentary filmmaker, former advisor at the Canadian Fordham Ministry. She's graduated from Oxford with distinction in international human law, rights law. And all that suggests a person who considers things and wants to explore the nature of things, wants to get to the meaning of things, as Jeff and I have had Charles Lipson, Professor Charles Lipson, and others on this program, to get to the meaning. But to do that, you have to cut away fat. And in a serious discussion of, let's take these weaponized Democratic talking points that suggest, that seek to conflate Republicans with white supremacists. And I guess now, from what I read, we all must be ground to dust. And what's always bothered me, Kaylin, if we could just stay on the topic that caused you so much grief, is that if you kick people to the margins of society, and in this case, 75 million people kicked to the margins, told that they're supremacists, that they're racist, that they're not part of society, bad things will happen. And the larger questions for me have always been to save the republic from internal strife. And so I wonder, you had this discussion about what happens when groups are kicked to the margins, and how to prevent that, how to seek to address the radicalization of white, disaffected white people in North America. And you were and you were destroyed for it. I mean, can't we have a rational conversation about what is going on culturally without being accused of heresy?
That's right. Yeah. And of course, this is one of the common critiques of cancel culture, particularly in more academic contexts, is that it exerts a real chill on sort of discursive democracy, on open inquiry, on our capacity even to think seriously about issues, because there are these invisible tripwires everywhere. There are certain things that you know, words that you can't use, even if you mean them in one with one sort of denotation, they could easily be misunderstood and conflated with something else. And what does that mean when that tendency captures your institutions, your democratic institutions, when it captures academia, when it captures the media? You lose the ability to think seriously and to contemplate truth and to seek it. The process of seeking truth in any scenario is often one that involves mistakes. It involves entertaining perspectives without necessarily holding them yourself, being able to consider different points of view. And that's now an extremely perilous thing to do, because intent no longer matters. When you're now reading through parts of someone's private conversation, their actual intent, the actual meaning, what the context really was, no longer matters.
When we reduce complicated issues to 140 characters, decorated by some anonymous cartoon head and hashtags, you really can't get to the meat of a subject. You're just getting tribal cant and the pounding of tribal drums, and it's dangerous. That's right. Dangerous for the country. And so in exile, you wrote this fascinating essay about exile called, as I said, They Can't Cancel Your Soul, published in the American Mind, and I think published elsewhere, most likely. And you speak about Hugo. You speak about many, many who have been canceled, and you say this that I thought, I'm trying to find it now, that I thought was so touching. It was about being vaporized, that you felt that you had been vaporized as a result.
That's right.
Ground to dust.
Yeah.
I'm looking for that passage now, but I can't wait. I can use this.
I've got it here.
Please read it.
Reads as a public person, I felt as if I had been vaporized or condemned to live as a kind of ghost, conscious, seeing everything, yet no longer part of the world. Lurking beneath Hugo's motto is Ovid's description of exile as living death, and I can do no better.
So you bring all these figures of literature and history to us in this wonderful essay, They Can't Cancel Your Soul. You can still find it, for those of you listening, you can still find it online at the American Mind. It's free. You can read it. Tell us about the essay and what that passage means.
Well, so that experience is, I've compared the experience of this kind of modern exile to, it feels like a sort of purgatory, because as I said, I no longer have it feels as though I no longer have a place in the world. I'm 2 years out now from this experience, and I remain effectively unemployable. I've struggled to find entry-level positions in my field. People who privately support me are afraid of any kind of public association with me still, because one of the features of cancel culture is that it operates by a logic of secondary guilt. So anyone who is even affiliated with a person feels that they risk being denounced and labeled as somehow guilty by association. And so people in public would avert my eyes, would pretend not to know me. People would scrub any record of a past association with me. And yet I remain living. I still have to pay my bills and pay my mortgage and take my kids to school. It's just that there's sort of the thread that connects me to my past and my future seems to have been severed. And that is an experience like being a ghost, or as I suggest in this essay, it's like an experience of purgatory. But there is, and I think most anyone who's been through this will tell you that it's an experience defined by a profound sense of alienation and loneliness. and one that very few people can understand if they haven't been through it themselves. But one of the consolations is that among our greatest literary and philosophical figures in history, a wildly disproportionate number of those people had analogous experiences. You know, from Dostoevsky to Victor Hugo, as you said, I say Seneca, to, you know, Levi and Suchere in the East, and you know, hundreds of others. This is, Dante. You know, even Confucius, in a sense, was, I say, he's not really an exile, but he was definitely a failure and a reject in his own time, who sometimes would have to flee assassination attempts in the states he tried ministering to. And so it's, you know, wrongful imprisonment, being wrongfully sentenced to death. You know, Boethius is one of my absolute favorites in this category, or they were sent into exile and had to watch from a distance what would have been their lives playing out without them in it anymore. And when you read these writings, that is where I've found a sense of camaraderie and understanding. I mean, these souls sort of greet you without judgment and without scorn and speak to you of themselves and of your own experiences. And of course, one of the great insights that comes from many of these figures is in this living death, you come to appreciate even the transience of all the worldly things that we would otherwise be occupying ourselves with, chasing after fame and position and comfort and titles and wealth. All of that gets taken away from all of us in the end. And in exile, at least, you come to appreciate that sooner, and you still have time to focus on the permanent things that can neither be given nor taken away. And those things, is, to paraphrase Seneca, it is your individual virtue. And so you still have time, at least, to try to work on that. And it's difficult, and I don't claim to be an exemplar necessarily, but that is a kind of gift.
I had almost an experience like that last year. I shall never forget it. But I was, I was saved by friends who stood up for me. Charles Lipson, many writers stood up for me and published support. But the scars still remain. Mm-hmm. And I can never go back to that place where I was, but I am interested. Have people reached out to you who've said, I'm sorry that I betrayed you, that I wasn't there for you?
That's a difficult question. I think it remains a bit of a raw nerve. There are some people who, I think, for whatever reason, and this is part of the torment of this, is that you never get an answer as to what those reasons are when people drop you from their lives. And so you're left wondering forever, is it that they, did they believe the worst in me? Were they ashamed at their sort of cravenness at the time? Was it just easier not to deal with it? You know, you never get an answer to those questions. All you know is that in your hour of greatest need, many of the people that you thought were friends are not there. And that's a kind of sort of hurt that doesn't easily go away. But at the same time, I can say that I've made many of the most meaningful friendships in my life, I think, have come out of this experience. A lot of people have reached out to me, and you know, whether or not they're bold enough to publicly associate with me, they're people who nonetheless had the sort of discernment and the kindness to say that this was an injustice and this is a person who deserves friends, or at least who needs friends, whether I deserve them or not. So there is that. And that is one thing to be enormously grateful for, that that the people who now fill my life, I think that, you know, certainly my social circle is in many ways circumscribed, as everyone's is over the last year.
Right.
But it's filled with people of tremendous quality, and I'm very grateful for that.
You are a documentarian. Are you working on any projects now? What is the future of Kaylin Ford?
I am. I never thought I would make another documentary. So my last two documentaries, almost ironically, were both centered on human rights issues in communist China. So I made a documentary about forced labor and religious persecution, and another that dealt with totalitarian propaganda, mass persuasion, and censorship. So my background sort of prepares me well, I think, in some ways for this. But yes, I'm currently working on a documentary about this thing that we call cancel culture. And it's sort of a first person perspective, but you know, grappling with the larger socio-political and philosophical dimensions of this.
On that front, there's a really interesting case study out of Smith College from a couple of years ago where a young co-ed thought she was being harassed or threatened by people because she was in the wrong place. And long story short, a bunch of cafeteria workers who had been at this place for a long time, too, now they can't find jobs because they were called racist by somebody without any proof or any real forethought. And it's terrifying. I just think hearing you talk about that, the idea that you're clearly qualified for lots of different things and not being able to find a position in the world again is just, it's hard to wrap my own head around it. And it makes me think then, well, what do I say to people? What do I, my comments when I'm trying to explain complex issues to people, where am I going to wind up in the pile or the heap of discarded personalities or thought leaders? It's terrifying that this the world we kind of come to. So I'm really looking forward to a documentary on this, because we've been talking, John and I have been talking about this and lots of others, that there needs to be a break point where we hopefully realize that this is destroying the integrity of being intellectually proper. It's weird.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess this is one of the ways that this works, is that the people driving these kind of, you know, outrage and public shaming campaigns are a tiny but extremely committed and very vocal minority. And it's fascinating to watch the process by which very small minorities can effectively cow and intimidate majorities. But the way it works is precisely because people are afraid. They're terrified, and they think that if you just keep your head down, that maybe they'll pass me over. Maybe I can sort of survive this with my career and reputation intact. But that's what they depend on. And, I remember when I went through this, a number of my friends who had fled communist China said, people may take issue with this analogy, but I'll try to qualify it appropriately. But my friend said, this is very familiar. This is, you've been through a Dojung campaign, a struggle session. And that's a reference to the Cultural Revolution, where for 10 years, but especially for, there's a period of a couple of years at the beginning, especially where Red Guards, so kind of young ideological zealots, were roving the countryside, denouncing people for being reactionaries, rightists, counter-revolutionaries. And any tiny piece of evidence could be used to level the charge. If they had a clipping from a foreign newspaper or a musical instrument or an article of worship in their home, or if someone just accused them of saying the wrong thing privately, they would be hauled out onto the street and mocked and humiliated and made to perform public confessions. This is also a familiar dynamic in cancel culture, is the expectation that you have to apologize and express contrition and promise to do better. It's the exact same thing. You promise to reform your thoughts and to do better.
I refuse.
Me too. I can't. This is, the curious thing about these forced confessions and apologies is, in my case, they're trying to make me apologize for holding beliefs that I don't hold. And Whether you're trying to make someone apologize for something that they never actually believed, or you're trying to make them apologize for something that they sincerely believe, either way, you're trying to make them lie. And so the people seeking these public apologies from you are not interested in your moral improvement. They are interested in your moral debasement. And I refuse to do it. I was happy to try to reason with people and to explain to people of goodwill who wanted an explanation, but no, I'm not going to capitulate to people who want to make me lie. And, you know, speaking of the Cultural Revolution, though, this is also a period where they were trying to eradicate their civilizational inheritance. It was a campaign to struggle against the four olds, the old culture and old ideas and old arts and values.
Oh, my. Is there a parallel here? I mean, I'm sorry, 1619 Project, the original sin, everything in the West is reduced to
decolonize the curriculum. Right. You know, it's an absolute culture of repudiation. And this is, I mean, it's very much the Cultural Revolution took in some ways much more extreme form. Some 2 million people died in the course of the Cultural Revolution. Many more committed suicide because of the public shamings. And we're not there, but the psychic impact is the same. And I think that the moral impact is very similar. And this is one of the points that I make, if you'll allow me, that I make in this essay, is that I wrote that cancel culture reflects and heightens the inverted priorities of the world. It incentivizes cruelty and performative outrage, and so suffocates humility, generosity, and openness. It asks us to go in search of grievances, to look for the bad in others, but never to reproach ourselves. It inflames tribal hatreds and artificial divisions, demands that people lie, that they confess to crimes they did not commit, that they conceal their true beliefs to preserve themselves. Envy, hubris, and wrath are rewarded, while prudence and a slowness to judgment are treated with suspicion, as though they're evidence of an insufficient commitment to the cause. In the name of love and tolerance and solidarity, it asks us to hate our enemies, inform on our neighbors, and desert our friends. And you know, that ultimately is my main critique of this thing, is it's not just that it is unjust to the individuals or that it chills free speech and open inquiry. It's that it perverts our capacity to engage in moral reasoning, and it debases us morally as human beings.
Kaylin Ford, I can't thank you enough for being here, and I want, please, when you're completed with the, when you've completed your project, your next documentary, I would very much like to talk to you about it and write about it and see it, of course. So thanks to you for being here. Jeff and I appreciate it, and I hope I...
Absolutely.
I would think our listeners do as well, because, well, I hate to brag, but I think our listeners are rather intelligent, and they can handle
it. Very thoughtful, yes, people.
Right. So thank you, Kaylin. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Talk soon.
Appreciate you.
Kaylin, if people want to learn more or find out more about you, or besides the article, or the essay rather, where would you direct them?
My website, kaylinford.com. I'm also on Twitter and not super active, but you can find me there.
Say again the website, because I somehow I had a...
And my name is difficult. It's kaylinford.com, C-A-Y-L-A-N, Ford, F-O-R-D.com.
Well, thank you again.
For Kaylin Ford, documentarian, canceled, the brilliant author of They Can't Cancel Your Soul. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer at WGN Radio. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, not a gardener, without a garden, damn it. Columnist at the Chicago Tribune, member of its editorial board, no garden. It's May. And for Lori Lightfoot, of course, who provides us with endless mirth, the gift who can't stop giving to us her bizarre takes on life. What happened to you, Lori? Thanks for joining us for another edition of the Chicago Way on WGN+.